The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, Shavuot Tov, how are you?
Shavuot Tov, Boker Tov. Some very serious words. It's very difficult to follow such a serious discussion and conversation that you're having.
Yeah, I just think, you know, it's very easy in the age that we live in to be so outraged by comments that people make. F.W. de Klerk was a member of the Nationalist Party. He was a racist, apartheid leader. The fact is that in his lifetime he did see South Africa through a transition, and we do need to be grateful to him for that. But the fact that he can make a statement that apartheid was not a crime against humanity is just appalling and pathetic. But it shouldn't be dominating our conversation as South Africans. We have tremendous issues. We're a country in crisis. We have so much to deal with, but it is so much easier to just go the outrage route because it requires so little of us in terms of intelligence, and that is my problem with that conversation.
Sort of linking to some degree with one of the conversations that I wanted to have about what's going on at the International Criminal Court, but we'll get there in due course.
All right.
I want to start with, with a really pleasant story before we get on to the heavier stuff. Gilad Shalit apparently has proposed engagement to his girlfriend Nitzan Shabbat. People will remember that Gilad Shalit was, of course, the Israeli soldier who was held in captivity in Gaza by Hamas for 5 years. And there was a picture of him and his girlfriend Nitzan that was put onto Instagram, apparently her showing an engagement ring. And so I'm happy for Gilad that he's got to the stage. Of course, we all recall the 5 years that he was in captivity. He was released back in 2011. We all remember, you know, the fact that there were more than 1,000 convicted Palestinian terrorists who were released in that particular exchange. I remember very well the day that he was released. I was talking about it live to listeners on the radio on that day about the events that were happening. Who can believe that more than 8 years have gone by since then? And now he's getting married, so I hope that that will be a very happy and successful marriage for both of them, and that he will be able to really get on with his life. Which I think, you know, in the circumstances after what he had to go through, was always going to be a difficult exercise.
How, do we know how he's doing? You know, you can't spend 5 years in captivity, in complete isolation, cut off from the rest of the world, and be okay. If I were his fiance's parents, I'd be a little bit nervous about letting my daughter marry somebody who's been through this type of experience.
Yeah, I mean, he's become very, very low profile since his release. I mean, obviously his parents made sure that his name, his story was in the news. We all remember, some of us remember back 8 years ago, more than 8 years ago, because of course it was 13 years ago that he was actually captured back in June of 2006. We remember that, and, you know, the fact that his name was very much on everybody's lips, and it was, you know, very much publicly in the news all the time. And then since his release, they've tried to bring the profile down significantly to allow him to get on with his life, to allow the family to kind of get back to some semblance of normality. So we don't know all the details about exactly how he's been doing. One of the newspapers did publish a whole series of relationships that he'd had. He apparently had a 4-year relationship with somebody that ended about 2 years ago. And then, you know, he's been in relationships with other people. Other than that, in terms of, you know, how he's been getting along, what his psychological state is, whether he's succeeded in getting education and work and things like that, I haven't really seen very much about that. And maybe that's just as well.
Yeah, absolutely, because that is perhaps how he does need to live his life. All right, let's just talk about the International Criminal Court. A number of countries have come out in support of Israel in its latest battle at the ICC. All right, which countries are supporting Israel?
We spoke a little bit earlier about, you know, war crimes and crimes against humanity and things like that. And this is Israel's battle at the International Criminal Court, where, of course, the Palestinian side have been trying desperately over a number of years to bring charges against Israel of crimes against humanity and about war crimes. Interestingly, on this particular occasion, a number of countries have stood up and said, this is not okay, that we don't think that there is a case to be answered here. So, aside from the fact that the chief prosecutor herself doesn't always necessarily agree with the rulings of the judges. And of course, we're talking about Fatou Bensouda, who has quite a reputation as a very, very senior, serious and quite influential individual. Mm-hmm. And she's had to fight the judges both for and against Israel. She was the one who stood up and said on the Mavi Marmara incident that she felt that there wasn't a case to be answered. The judges forced her again to rethink it, and she kept on coming back to them to say that there is no case to be answered. On this occasion, it seems as if though she thinks that there is a case to be answered by Israel, and she has been asked and encouraged by the Palestinian side to investigate the events of the, you know, most recent incursion into Gaza, the most recent Operation Protective Edge, and some of the things that happened during the course of that particular event. But it's interesting that Brazil, Hungary, Austria, Germany, the Czech Republic, Australia, and of course the United States, which we shouldn't forget, which hasn't been included on some of the lists, they have all stood up very vociferously arguing that really this is a waste of the time, of the court, and that there really isn't a case to be answered. The thing that's really confusing for me is that on the one hand, Israel and the United States are not signed up to the International Criminal Court and the Rome Statute, which really governs the way that the International Criminal Court works. So they specifically rejected and decided not to sign up to the International Criminal Court. On the other hand, the Palestinian Authority specifically did sign up to the Rome Statute and was accepted. And therein lies some of the confusion for me, because as a non-state a signatory to the Rome Statute, the question is whether there is any jurisdiction by the court over things that happen in the Palestinian Authority area, and specifically in Gaza, in East Jerusalem. Does that mean that the International Criminal Court has jurisdiction over that? And many of the countries are arguing that there is no jurisdiction. I don't understand what standing Israel has, and to that, to the same extent, what standing the United States has under the International Criminal Court, given that they haven't signed up at all, and yet the International Criminal Court seems to think at least that it has jurisdiction to bring actions against members who are not members, people, countries that have not signed up to the Rome Statute and signed up to the International Criminal Court. So this for me is a case of a lot of confusion. We see that the Organization for Islamic Cooperation, which represents 57 Muslim states, has been asking to file a brief at the International Criminal Court. Now that's a group of, that's an organization that represents a group of countries that doesn't have any standing under the International Criminal Court whatsoever. So all of this is very confusing for me, but thankfully we've got the US really, supporting our cause. And of course, some of the other countries that I mentioned who are in fact signed up to the International Criminal Court. So, I don't think that this is going to go away in a hurry. This was a subject that was addressed by Prime Minister Netanyahu yesterday at the weekly cabinet meeting. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to see this one rolling on for a while yet. The question that, you know, the accusation that's been placed at Israel, upon Israel, that it has committed crimes against humanity and war crimes during Operation Protective Edge, which of course is really, really ridiculous when you see the extent to which the IDF has gone to try to avoid the so-called collateral damage, to try to avoid civilian casualties, and yet these accusations are being placed upon Israel. Really ridiculous.
Yeah, amazing. And it is something, a story obviously that, as you say, will go on for a while. I found this an incredible, incredible story, that prayers were held yesterday at the Kotel for those suffering from COVID-19 virus. If first of all, is it affecting Israel at the moment? But tell us about this, because I found this an incredibly, I actually found it very moving.
Well, there were prayers yesterday at the Kotel yesterday afternoon. Tehillim was said, you know, special psalms were recited, not only for those people who have been diagnosed with the virus, but indeed for those people who are in lockdown over the virus. Of course, which are many, many more people. And of course, the families of those who are suffering from this lockdown situation. There were quite a large group of people who gathered at the Kotel in spite of what seemed to be not such very favorable weather. They said prayers, they said psalms, Tehillim, they sang, they even danced around, and people were praying that some sort of a cure could be found for the virus, for the disease. This was really promoted mostly by the chief rabbi of Sfat, who also, as well as the president of the rabbinical community association, Rabbi Shmuel Eliyahu, he was the person who was really driving all of this in association with the U.S. Orthodox Union. So I think it was, a nice gesture. Israel doesn't have any people who have been diagnosed in Israel with COVID-19. However, that dreaded ship that is still in Yokohama Harbor, and that slowly but surely more and more people have been contracting the disease. It seems almost like an incubator for COVID-19. I'm not quite sure what the logic was to leave all of those people on board that ship. There are 15 Israelis amongst thousands of other people who were not allowed to disembark in Yokohama. The Japanese authorities have said no to that. And then one by one, people have been diagnosed with the virus. And it seems to me that as soon as you get diagnosed with the virus, you're allowed to come off the ship. So they've been taking people off the ship one by one. But now there are hundreds of people who have been diagnosed with the virus on the ship. So I don't understand why they didn't just let people come to the ship to begin with. Mm. And it could have avoided those hundreds of people having been exposed to the virus, and they could have come home and probably been quite healthy. But as it turns out, 3 out of the 15 Israelis on that ship have apparently been diagnosed. We understand that the foreign ministry has been militating against the Japanese authorities and even have sent a ministry of health officials over to Japan to negotiate the release of those Israelis from the ship. They've been promised that they will be put into isolation. The rules in Israel are quite stringent at the moment. People who come to Israel from a whole list of countries have been told that they have to go into a 2-week isolation, self-isolation. They can either do it themselves or they can turn up at a medical facility and they can be, they can be housed there while they go into this 2-week isolation to ensure that they don't have the disease. But it's people coming from Thailand, from Hong Kong, from China, of course, from Macau. A whole list of countries are being forced into isolation. Fortunately, as of now, no Israelis have been diagnosed in Israel. But as we've already discussed before, the health ministry is only, they've just said it's only a matter of time before somebody will be diagnosed. And there are some really nasty stories about people in Israel, Chinese people from the Far East, who actually have been, people are really looking at them in a very, very different way, almost like some sort of a,
I think that's no different anywhere, Anthony. Unfortunately, we've been talking about it on our show quite a bit, is that there's we've coined the term germ racist, but there is that.
Yeah.
There is that uneasy feeling. Kate's asking, does Anthony have any information about the new masks that Israel made and sent to China? I did see something, but I can't recall any details around it. I don't know if you can or if you know anything about that.
There was a story about special masks that had been produced in Israel and that were being sent, but we don't hear very much about that at the moment, and I think that with the number of victims that are being diagnosed and the extent to which masks have become one of the most sought-after products on the shelves, not only in Israel, but it seems around the world. I haven't heard a great deal, not about the masks and also not about the vaccine that the Israelis were so gung-ho about producing. There was, orders by the Prime Minister to set up vaccine-producing facilities. I haven't heard a great deal more about that at all, but I'll have a look at it and perhaps we can
On that note, I do want to, we had Dr. Anton Marburg, a pulmonologist, on the show. He's done an amazing amount of work on the coronavirus. And I was chatting to him yesterday. Somebody asked him the question, what should they do? They traveling this week, they're traveling to Europe this week, what should they be concerned, what should they do? And his advice was that when you are in an airport, wear a mask. If you, you know, when you're getting off your plane, when you're getting off a plane, especially if you're transiting from somewhere, put on a mask. Make sure that it's a decent mask that you that doesn't allow particles through. Wear the mask in the airport. When you're outside the airport, there really shouldn't be an issue. Certainly not in Europe, and certainly not in in most places like that. But during that, in that confined space where you've got people coming from all sorts of places in the world, one person coughing next to you can really have an impact. So I thought that was very sensible advice if any of our listeners are looking to travel in the next couple of weeks, just to make sure that you have a mask on hand. Anthony Reich, thank you as always. It is 8:01. Unfortunately, our news is slightly late. Here's Zanati with the news headlines and the news.